person who shares satisfaction in learning in terms of somebody who's not only exciting, but ridiculously convincing. And if you're hanging around the Shiro line and not to know, I like a combination of both. It's important to be creative and exciting, but it's far more important to be compelling. How do we go about finding the compelling there after we move? Because I think it's the point of the topic. It's an opportunity to take a step back from what we do day to day when we learn the team or Kakim, but rather to think about what is our point? What is our driving force behind it? So Rabbi Karmi wrote a book, our Rabbi Karmi, he edited a book put out by the Orthodox Forum back in 1996. It's an incredibly important book. And on the back for further study, we have it mentioned, so if you haven't read the chapter on Tanakh, there, just in terms of sheer hashtagic greatness and importance, this book is very important. It has different essays by some of the greatest building Tanakh people in the world in terms of the broader issues that come up in hashtagic learning. So it hardly deals with what he likes to call the literary theological approach. I don't have a better term for it than a perfectly good one. The literary theological approach, the way he defines it, essentially is comprised of two parts. Part number one is that we study the Baruch Hashem officially as the Baruch Hashem. We're not apologetic about it. We don't try to hide that under the rug when we talk about it. It's very much why we're learning. That's number one. Number two is that we are surrounded by Torah Sheba'al Peh and traditional Mefarshim. These are not ancillaries. They're not treated on as an equal playing field with contemporary scholarship, but very much so we let them define the terms of our study, meaning our Hashkafot, the boundaries of learning, and the methodological principles that we have. That's completely defined by Chazal and traditional Mefarshim. The third component of it is the trying to understand to the best of our ability Tanakh as it was understood by the writers of Tanakh. So the Torah was primarily intended by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the rest of Nakh as it was intended by the later Nevi'im and people writing Ruach HaKodesh who composed those Sfarim. In order to do that last one, that means we have to understand how words were used in the time of Tanakh. It means to the best of our ability we have to understand the historical underlying context that Tanakh is written in, because after all, Tanakh, as we all know, it doesn't just talk about abstract theology. It's not Moreh Nebuchim or some similar type of sefer. Very much many of the Sfarim are dependent entirely on history, meaning that it's talking about Devar Hashem as it is reflected through historical reality. The more that we can understand any of those things, the better off we are, without any doubt, and that's how our Parshanut has always taken it. So Rabbi Karmi uses the term literary and theological. Our Mefarshim didn't have terminology like that, but essentially they tried to do the same thing. And from time immemorial, that's what we've been up to. Rabbi Elchanan Samet, to my mind, I discovered him a long time ago, and I liked him. He wrote a lot of things on Sefer Melachim in the journal called Megadim, particularly his bond of Eliyahu Navi and Elisha Navi. He already put out a Sefer called Pirkei Eliyahu a couple of years ago, which essentially is an expansion of all of his Eliyahu Navi articles. Now I just have been told that he's trying to put out a Sefer called Pirkei Elisha, where he's going to do the same thing with his Elisha articles. Strongly recommended in all regards. But to my mind, his masterpieces are what he has to say about the Chumash. He outdoes himself, so to speak. It's really fantastic. The virtual Beit Midrash of Har Etzion, they put out these weekly Parshat HaShavua things. He did it in the year 2000 and again in 2003. And they're already published in the full Hebrew forms in Yevanim Parashat HaShavua. If you haven't already read them, you don't even need to invest. You can get it all free on the web. And make sure you have a good toner cartridge and print and print and print and read them all. The English translations are slightly reduced adaptations. They're not the full glory of the articles, but they're certainly good enough to get your feet wet with this methodology. Here are some of the things that I like about him, and I just wanted to point them out, and then we'll actually do one example inside in the text to show what he actually does in practice. First off is that he is entirely text-centric, meaning he's not going to just make statements and say, believe me because I'm Rav Samet. He's not going to say, believe them because Rashi said so. He's going to say, Rashi said so, and look how that fits so nicely. And I'm going to show you how that maps out in the text. Another thing that's very unusual about him, although, my style, I'm very conservative with a lowercase c. I don't feel like there's any great pressing need to have a chidush if you don't need one. It's quite fine if you have a machlok at Rashi and Ramban, and you work out the more likely and less likely views. It's fine if you kind of stay there, as long as you can find a compelling reading. Rav Samet does that quite a lot in his Iyunim. He doesn't feel the need always to come up with something creative and new that is his own. He works through the evidence the same way every time. And if, in fact, Ramban or Rav Yitzchak Rama or Rav Yitzchak Barbanel or whoever says it, great. And if he feels the need to show a development of ideas over the centuries, he does that as well. But he's quite equal opportunity. He lets the chips fall where they are supposed to fall. He has an incredible mastery both of the text of Tanakh as well as Chazal and Mefarshim. There's no question that he's read pretty much anything that's in print within reason, and he has an incredible handle on it. One thing we have to zachor l'tov, Rav Nachman Rabinovich, who's the Rosh Hashiva of Birkat Moshe, Rav Yochanan Thomas started his career there as a Ram. And he talked to Marashi Urim like everybody else, and he gave a chug in Tanakh. It was very much on the side. Somehow Rav Rabinovich, who's the Rosh Hashiva there, found out that he's just a Tanakh genius. And he said, stop, you're not allowed to give your Gemara Shiur anymore. You're going to be doing Tanakh full time for the rest of your life. And he still learns Gemara, don't worry. But primarily he spends most of his time doing Tanakh, and Zachor L'tov Rabinovich, for seeing that genius in him, the last 20 years that's what he's been doing, really pursuing Tanakh on a very high level and being able to write the way that he's been writing. What he does when he wants to bring in ancient Near East sources, which he does from time to time, or else contemporary literary scholarship, which he also does, he makes sure to point out that that's not the Ikar, but rather it's coming into a traditional framework. In other words, these voices are going to be heard, but very much within the context of Haran Yirat Shamayim. And also, as I mentioned earlier, he's unapologetically Yirat Shamayim. He's not doing this in order to teach intellectual truth. He's using intellectual truth as a means to the end of Avodat Hashem, which is really the point of why we learn Tanakh, or at least it should be the point of why we learn Tanakh. So those are some of the major issues of what Rav Sama does in the abstract. But I don't like talking in the abstract, I like learning. So I wanted to do a double shiur of his, because he talks about this is in his first series of shiurim, meaning the year 2000 rather than 2003, or the Yonim Parashat HaShavua, the first series rather than the second series. In Lech Lecha and Vayera, he deals with a very central issue that we all have to reckon with. You know the general rule of thumb, by the way, just for the record, this is my usual caveat, he's the only one in my life who I've co-opted shiurim from, by the way, Rav Samet. I draw from everybody, and I usually end up weaving together shiurim. It takes an awful lot of time to put together shiurim. He's the first one I found where pretty much I could just block and paste, I give him credit, don't worry, and block and paste, you know, abridge a little bit because the whole thing in an hour or whatever it is usually, there's too much going on. So I just have repeatedly in my kehilah dealing with Balabatim, some of whom have amazing learning skills and some of whom have really never learned before, and they're blown away every time. I mean, I pick the ones that I think will blow them away. I don't do all of them. But the ones that are blow-away caliber are simply phenomenal. So here are a couple of those that have worked very well in a completely general audience, but I think also can work quite well in a yeshiva audience. So this is him again, Lech Lecha Vayera. So my usual caveat whenever I co-opt shiurim from him, and I'll do the same thing here, is that not only am I abridging, but occasionally I editorialize, meaning that you have to read the originals and you can get it all again on the web. You can see where he goes, where he stops, and where I continue. But largely, this is straight out of him. Rule number one of all Tanakh learning, not really the first rule, but it's the rule number one for tonight. And that is, whenever HaKadosh Baruch Hu talks, it is true. Whenever a narrator in Tanakh talks, it also is true. Why? Because the narrator is either in the Torah HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself, if it's later books of Nevi'im, we're dealing with Nivuah. The objective voice of the narrator is truth, as far as we are concerned from a learning standpoint. So if there's ever a machloket, for example, between HaKadosh Baruch Hu and a character, the character is wrong. So if Yonah ben Amittai, for example, even though he's a Navi, is having a significant conflict with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, bottom line is HaKadosh Baruch Hu is right, Yonah ben Amittai is wrong. We may struggle to understand A, what is he up to anyway? B, why is he wrong? And that's subject to tremendous machloket. It's a hard sefer to fully understand. But at the end of the day, if you side with Yonah ben Amittai against HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you're making a mistake. That's very simple. Likewise, if there's a conflict between the narrator of a sefer and anybody, including Nevi'im or anybody else, the narrator wins. So that's just the way it goes. If people speak, well, it depends who the person is. If the person happens to be a Navi and he's speaking b'nevuah, that's still HaKadosh Baruch Hu talking, meaning it's using a Navi as a mouthpiece. But if a person talks, even if that person is a Navi, not the Nivuah, well then that person might still be right, because people are right on occasion, but they also might be wrong. Classic examples of this, of course, include Shmuel HaNavi thinking that Eliyahu ben Yishai would be the king. And so he says, oh, here we go. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, sorry, you're wrong, and I have somebody else in mind, and David ends up being the king. Similarly, Natan HaNavi, when David HaMelech wants to build the Beit HaMikdash, says, I would like to build the Beit HaMikdash. And Natan HaNavi says, sure. And of course, we're all thinking the same thing as readers. There's no reader who goes through the whole life and times of David HaMelech who isn't convinced. Of course, David HaMelech, the climax of his life is going to be that he's going to get to build the Beit HaMikdash. It's his dream. And instead, HaKadosh Baruch Hu commands Natan to go back right in there, and it's not going to happen. These are two classic and celebrated cases of Nevi'im speaking not as Nevi'im, but rather as people. And in these cases, we know that they're speaking as people because God corrects them. And so that's the way that these things go. So, getting to our narratives about Abraham Avinu and Sarah Imenu, we love them dearly. We are all descended of them, either physically or spiritually, depending on if they're Gerut in our family, somewhere along the line. And we hold them in very high esteem. Plus, at least Abraham Avinu is a known Navi, and typically we think of Sarah Imenu also as a Naviyah. The question still is, though, when they act in the Torah, are their actions always to be judged favorably? Meaning, do we look to them as, we always want to be like this? Or are there times that we are critical of them? This is a classical machloket among all Chazal and Mefarshim down to the present. Sometimes the stakes get very high, and sometimes passions run a little bit too high on this issue. But this is a classic issue that all Chazal and Mefarshim deal with, as they are required to. So in the case at hand, if you look at Bereshit Tev Zayin, so you know the story. The story is that Abraham Avinu is promised by HaKadosh Baruch Hu that his descendants are going to inherit the land. Downside is he has no descendants. And he's very, very concerned about that. For a little while, it seems like Lot is going to be the winner. Off to Sodom he goes, forget about him. He might adopt even his servant Eliezer. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, forget it. Eliezer is going nowhere. Then finally, Sarai Imenu feels that she needs to intervene. After all, at this point in the story, she's 75 years old, she's barren. There's no reason in the world to believe that she's going to have any children. So she takes that bold step, which is really, really, really heroic, and gives Hagar to Abraham. Abraham consents, Hagar gets pregnant. Hagar, at the end of Pasuk Dalet, which is right before the text that we have in front of us, what does that mean? So her mistress, meaning Sarah, was now lightly esteemed in her eyes. What does that mean? What did Hagar do? So, help me out here. Won't come out well on the tape, but that's okay. Somebody learned something sometime. I know that Torah is not a text here, but we still learn it.
Mocked
her, how so? So certainly this seems to be part of it, and quite well might be what's going on. That she's mocking it, saying, hey, you want to feel? Or something like that. And plus, Sarah Imenu obviously is not just heartbroken. She feels rejected by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, presumably, for not having children, particularly given that there is a covenant here. This was a tormenting thing, yeah. Oh, we have a very interesting phenomenon going on over here. What does Hagar's status become, really? And this is what you're referring to, both with Rashi, Radak talks about this in much greater length. What happens to Hagar's status? She used to be a maiden. Now she's married, kind of, to Abraham, and she's pregnant with Abraham's baby. What's her status? Is she now free? Is she still Sarah's maid? Does her legal status change? That's a really interesting question, and we have to go back to that as well. Okay, regardless, Hagar seems to be insensitive, and we already don't like her very much, because we know how heartbroken Sarah must be. We know how devastated she must be to see this. And this is where we pick up in our text. Vatomer Sarai el Abraham, Chamasi alecha, Abraham Avinu, I'm furious at you. Poor Abraham Avinu. He could have said, Kani, you made the shidduch. Right? I'm just doing what you asked me to do. Abraham Avinu, this was not Abraham Avinu's initiative. You did this, and look, we're doing the right thing, no? But nonetheless, Sarai Imenu is furious at him. May God judge between us. That's not light language. Elsewhere, that usually means whoever's right, may HaKadosh Baruch Hu adjudicate between us. That means may he punish whoever's wrong. And Sarah clearly has an idea of who is the wrongful party here, namely your husband. This is stunning effort that Avraham Avinu. So Avraham Avinu says, Vayomer Avraham al Sarai, Hinei Shefateich Biyadech, So Sarai, how do you translate Bateaneha? Inui? Well, right. Inflicted suffering upon. Tortured her, whatever. What does that mean? What did she do? Huh? Avodat Parah. She might have broken out her whip. Okay. What else? Could be. How could Bateaneha, because this is the key word in our ongoing discussion. Okay, so overworked. However this is understood, Radak and Ramban's eyes bug out over here, as you're well aware. Some Mefarshim justify it, because after all, we're dealing with Abraham and Sarah here, and we don't like Hagar very much because she was so insensitive to Sarai to begin with. But Radak says what Sarah did here is terrible. She had absolutely, and Radak, by the way, thinks that this includes physical affliction, meaning that, yeah, she beat her up. It wasn't just that she put her to work, but rather she actually beat her and presumably verbally oppressed her also, and basically drove her crazy until Hagar felt the need to run out of the house. Ramban agrees with Radak, but then adds that Abraham too is to be blamed because he should have taken an active role in intervening. He should have said, look, this was the deal. She's carrying my baby, and I'm not going to let you just torture her like this. And Ramban blames Abraham for not standing in the way of Sarah, rather than just saying, okay, look, do whatever you want, I'm staying out of this. Yeah?
Also, you could say, but down there, how could mean that Sarah didn't want Abraham to have relations with Hagar again to have more children. So it could be something that, you know, I don't want to see more of this. This is one child is enough, it's part of me already. Have more children, it's going to make it more.
It's very interesting, it sounds like you're drawing off of the Initem and Ashotechem and the various Inuyim that we have, even though the Biyah one is Mechonan. That being said, right now she's pregnant, and therefore the likelihood of her having, she can't now get more pregnant, even though technically speaking, that might be what she's thinking about, right? Okay, so that all being said, this is a very strong accusation being made by Radak and Ramban against our patriarch and matriarch over here. Abraham Avinu and Sarai Imenu are currently being accused of doing some very serious wrong. And by the way, this is a very unpleasant story, and the fact of the matter is that Malach Hashem comes to Hagar and says, you're going to be blessed, and you're going to have a child, Yishmael, and Hagar, of course, comes back. How do we evaluate the judgment of Radak and Ramban here? Do we just say, well, they actually have a good point, I'm also uncomfortable with this story? Or you can say, no, let's try to defend Abraham and Sarah somehow, in which case we're going to try to put down the accusations of Radak and Ramban. Not all Mefarshim agree with Radak and Ramban. How do we even go about approaching this story? Rav Samet just enumerates four steps, which again are basic steps. None of this is Hiskidush at all. Step number one is we have to understand what the practices were in that setting, what actually happened in the ancient world in exactly this setting. In other words, Sarai Imenu is not the one who invented the practice of giving her maid to her husband when she's unable to bear children. This obviously was a well-known practice, and Sarai and Abraham were fully aware of it, and Hagar was fully aware of it. Were there laws governing this sort of practice? What happened? What is the legal status of Abraham, Sarai, and Hagar in this instance? That's question number one. Question number two is the usual three-pronged plan that I always talk about in Shior, namely, we have to look at these words in a vacuum, then we have to look at the words not in a vacuum, let's see the rest of the perek, and then not only the rest of the perek, but how does that perek fit into the rest of everything? So in our case, we have to understand what these words mean. We have to understand what the Malach Hashem's response is going to be, the rest of the perek, and we have to understand this story in the context of all the other stories about Abraham and Sarah, particularly as they pertain to, who is Abraham Avinu's heir going to be in the end? In other words, how is HaKadosh Baruch Hu going to fulfill his covenant with Abraham, already back from Lech Lecha Me'aretzcha? Those are the questions that we have to answer, no matter what our conclusions are going to be. Don't answer those, we have no response. So first off, let's look at the ongoing psukim. Pasuk Zayin. Vayimtza'a malach Hashem al ein hamayim bamidbar al ha'ayim b'derech shor. So an angel finds Hagar. Now, by definition, Malach Hashem is a physical, so to speak, physical manifestation of HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself. Angels don't have their own opinions in these stories. And therefore, whatever an angel says, it's the equivalent of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is saying it, because they're kind of one and the same, albeit they're used in slightly different forms. By Yomar, Hagar Shivchat Sarai. Well, first off, he calls her Shivchat Sarai, kind of like interface. And it's unusual. The Torah never wastes words, and certainly Malachi Hashem don't waste any words. You usually cut to the point right away. The idea that he says Shivchat Sarai right away is at least attention drawing. Emizelbat ba'anateleichi, which sounds just like HaKadosh Baruch Hu when he's busy tracking down Adam and Chava after they're hiding in Gan Eden, or Cain after he murdered his brother. You know, opening up conversation. Fleeing from Sarai, my mistress. You know, she's moda, but she's still very much the servant in this package. This pasuk demonstrates that Radak and Ramban's attack against Sarai is unfounded. Why? Because if it were immoral,
then Hashem would have said to go back and imprison.
Yeah, whatever "vihitani tachad yadeh" means, the fact that the angel is saying to go back and do it, and you'll get more of this inui, whatever it is,
Kadosh Baruch Hu is not going to support something that's immoral or wrongful. So by definition here, the question of Radak and Ramban seems to have been leveled not based on textual evidence, but based on what? Radak and Ramban are basing themselves on the way that many of us feel. The modern reader, and not just modern today, but 12th and 13th century readers also, when they read this story, we all respond based on the way we see things. And the way we see things is, what's going on here? How can Sarab treat Hagar this way? And so it seems very much that this pasuk rejects their criticism. We still have to understand the story. It sounds like the majority of the Mefarshim who defend Abraham and Sarah in this instance are correct, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu seems to be supporting them. So let's read on. Yomer l'malach Hashem, harber ben tarech, lo yisafer meirov. A big bracha goes to Hagar. In other words, go back to Sarai, v'itani tachad yadech, whatever that means, but let it be known that your descendants are to be blessed. Yomer l'malach Hashem, inat harav yolad ben v'karat shemo Yishmael, ki shema Hashem el onyech. Very interesting how Inui is used over here also. This seems to be referring to her suffering. And so since HaKadosh Baruch Hu heard the suffering, he's now going to reward her, so to speak.
Couldn't you still support the question by saying that if it wasn't anything beyond the norms, then why would you be getting a bracha? I mean, the fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is willing to mount it as a great thing would imply that something is not normal as a great thing. That he is asking her to go back against what is her better choice possibly. For whatever reason that is, maybe why if HaKadosh Baruch Hu is supporting it is another story. Whether or not you would support something that's immoral, I don't know, but I'm just saying maybe the fact that he's asking to go back and then saying, because you're going back, we give you a great blessing, does seem that he's supporting something that wouldn't be the expected normal or regular person.
Oh, so you could be saying that this whole thing is a reward to Hagar for going back. Or, let me be biased, because I'm very pro-Abraham Avinu here for a moment. She is currently carrying Abraham Avinu's child. It sounds like this covenant, yes, it's to her, but it's really to the Zerah Abraham. We have a very complex situation. I mean, we all know that if you're a firstborn, you are going to lose. But Abraham Avinu doesn't yet know this rule, right? Right at the moment, he's going to favor Yishmael for a little while until finally HaKadosh Baruch Hu says no. That seems to be what's going on here. This is part of the complex of the bigger picture, so it appears. How is HaKadosh Baruch Hu going to fulfill his promises to Abraham Avinu? Which includes numerous descendants, and that his descendants are going to inherit the land. You could still be right that this is meant as a reward locally to Hagar, and in a vacuum I cannot argue with you. I think in the broader context it seems more likely that it's dealing with the Abraham complex rather than just with Hagar's immediate actions, but we'll see. There's a very wide range of interpretation over Pere Adam in our Parshanut. One approach is, he's going to be a big behemoth, right? It's a very derisive term from one point of view. He's going to be uncultured and uncouth and barbaric of sorts. And that's what's meant here. In other words, you're going to be very blessed with many children, but alas, they're not going to be so well-mannered. What can I tell you? You know, that's what you're getting. Ibn Ezra disagrees. He says elsewhere when the term para in Tanakh is used. Para, we use the expression free as a bird. Well, back then they used free as a para. Para represents this desert animal that has no master, no boss, and freely roams, and nobody bothers it. The idea is, from that point of view, within Ibn Ezra's reading, you, Hagar, have to go back to be a slave, but your children are going to be free, in which case this is a blessing rather than an insult to all of her progeny. Once we have all these different pieces worked out, Rav Samet now takes into account one other little feature which is not in our text, and that is the Code of Hammurabi. Code of Hammurabi is a code written by King Hammurabi, of course, of Babylonia, Mesopotamia. And he actually lived right around the time of Abraham Avinu, by the way, if you work out your chronologies. When I was in the British Museum a few years ago, I made sure, first I had to go visit the Assyrians and scowl at them, because I really don't like the Assyrians. And so you should know that there's a picture of Sargon, who's the father, looking at his son, Sancheriv. Sancheriv ultimately is the one who destroyed all but Yerushalayim in the south. And their faces are defaced. You should know for the record that I didn't do that. Somebody else disliked them also and made sure to do it. It's the kind of thing I would have had the temptation to do, but then of course, I'm a very good fellow. I don't touch any museum things ever, but I stared at that picture with unusual satisfaction. After I took care of the Assyrians, then I went over to the Rosetta Stone where you see the Code of Hammurabi, which is really very interesting and it helps in multiple ways because it's translated into different languages, which helps scholars who found it decode some of these other languages. It's a really very handy thing. On the Code of Hammurabi, paragraphs 144 to 147, if you want to look them up, actually deals with exactly our situation, not with Abraham and Sarah, but with the law of what happens when a maid marries the boss, what's her status? The answer is, she remains a slave. The problem here emotionally is that since she's married to the prince, and this Abraham Avinu is really mamasha prince, and since she's bearing the prince's child, it's all too easy for her, in this case Hagar, to feel, I'm now free. I'm no longer going to be Sarah's maid or slave, but rather I'm now a free woman. I'm an equal wife to Sarah, and in some ways more, because I'm going to bear Abraham Avinu's child. Well, the Code of Hammurabi is clear on this point. Tough. Sarah is right. Sarah is absolutely allowed to reassert her mastery over the slave in this exact situation. So what seems to be happening over here, based on the reading of the words that we have in front of us and based on this law? Exactly that. It's exactly what Rashi, to some degree, and Radak, to a large degree, already said. Namely, Hagar started strutting around saying, I'm no longer your slave. I no longer look to you as my mistress. But rather, I'm free. And therefore, Sarai was furious. It's bad enough and humiliating enough that she's not going to have her husband's child, rather it's got to go through the surrogate. But it's worse that Hagar is now breaking free as a result of it. It's total humiliation in every which way. So Abraham Avinu says, your choice. Bateanea Sarai batibrach mipaneah. Bateanea sometimes does mean oppressed, and sometimes does even mean beat. But sometimes in Tanakh it simply means enslaved, such as in source number 3 over here, Vayasimu alav sarei misim, right at the beginning of Shemot, Laman ano tovasib lo tam. This is not necessarily a reference to whipping our ancestors, but rather just the fact that they were forced into slavery. The logic is that inui can very well mean, Sarai said, sorry, you're not free at all. You're still very much my slave. Hagar at this point had such tormented emotions over this issue because she feels free. She's bearing the master's son. And now Sarai is right. So what does she do? She runs away. So the angel comes and says, well, actually the law is with Sarai. You've got to go back. Right? In other words, they're all simply following the norms of that time. Yeah?
Why would an angel why would he want to follow the norms of that time?
You're asking an excellent question. Obviously, HaKadosh Baruch Hu and Malachim are not bound by the Code of Hammurabi, right?
Yes.
You're completely right in getting there. We hardly would expect them to. But the fact is that Sarah is following a conventional norm right now. Therefore, it's not immoral, even though we're still uncomfortable with it. And by the way, it seems like the Torah, even though Sarah is not wrong, the Torah does seem to be uncomfortable. You're absolutely right with these norms. Why? After all, look how sympathetic this narrative is, and the one that we're going to look at in just a minute, Parakaf Aleph also, R to Hagar, and later on to Hagar and Ishmael. Very sympathetic. If they're really immoral, and if Sarah was completely fine and everything was good, the text would turn very much against Hagar and Ishmael for breaking the law. And very much they don't. Why? Because HaKadosh Baruch Hu is trying to teach us a much higher level of morality from the Code of Hammurabi, and that seems to be one of the points of the story, actually.
It's like for us, looking at it from like a distant perspective, like we get a higher lesson out of it.
The Torah very much is going to push us to a much, much, much higher level of morality, not only with the Talachot, but even in the narratives. It's telling us that those norms don't hold water. In other words, they're nice. But Hammurabi, at least there are some code. But nothing compared to what the Torah is already asking for in the time of Bizman HaAvot. Very good. So that seems to be what's going on. And all of a sudden this whole story matches, not just because of, oh, Hammurabi has given us pshat, Adarabah. Hammurabi gives us a sense of understanding of the context of what's going on with these laws, but the words, all our Mefarshim already read all these words long before they knew anything at all about the Code of Hammurabi, and that's the point of what's going on over here. Namely, Hagar tried to break free, just to summarize these points. She really felt free. Sarai therefore said, sorry, you're still my slave. Hagar couldn't stand that, so she ran away. The angel says, no, you got to go back, be her slave, but your son and your descendants will be numerous, and he will be para adam, he will be free. You're not going to remain eternal slave. It's worth your going back and being a slave now. Swallow your ego, Hagar, follow the rules, and your children are going to have a divine blessing, which not said any better than that. Yeah.
How do we understand Sarai and their
It seems like she wanted him to do something. In other words, Hagar presumably was strutting very peacock-esque, or PN, she's a woman. But the peacock is long called with fancy feathers. So anyway, let's stick with the peacock. Anyway, she's strutting around the house. Abraham Avinu presumably sees Sarah's torment and does nothing. So Sarah is frustrated. Why are you doing nothing? That's beyond what we have in front of us. That seems to be, again, that's nothing to do with Hammurabi at all. That seems to be, anyway, what she's upset with Abraham about. Okay, good. Part two of the story is in Vayera. Now already Ishmael is alive and Yitzchak is alive. So source number two. Atera Sarah ben Hagar mitzrit asher yaldal Abraham mitzachek. So you understand that this word Yitzchak, mitzachek, litzachek is all over the place. It really affects and impacts on the Yitzchak part of the story. Now he's mitzachek. Well, mitzachek has a very wide range of meanings. It could go from Jibui Arayot type of stuff, which is how certain midrashic lines take it. That would be horrific. It could be more plausibly in the pshat realm that he's mocking Yitzchak. He's being a typical big brother, and he's mocking Yitzchak all over the place. And plus, of course, Ishmael could be mocking him not just, ha-ha, I'm bigger than you, but he could be saying, ha-ha, I know a fancy word called primogeniture, which means that the firstborn inherits all in our world. And Yitzchak could just say, ha-ha, I know the Torah Baruch HaKodesh, and the Torah tells you that firstborns always lose. I'm a firstborn, so it is a hang-up of mine, yes. But we really know that this is the case. In other words, the fact of the matter is, he could be mocking just as an annoying big brother, or even just in terms of more serious things, such as inheritance. The reason why the inheritance thing makes a lot of sense in context is that this is what Abraham, Sarah, and for that matter, HaKadosh Baruch Hu are concerned about in the remainder of this passage. But before we get there, mitzachek could also mean playing with his trucks. Right? In other words, it doesn't necessarily have to be negative at all. It could very well be that Sarah looks at Ishmael, and now he's a teenager, he's 14 years old or so, he's playing around. And Sarah realizes, you know, my husband's not getting any younger. We're going to have issues of inheritance one day. Who's going to get it? And so what happens next? Pasuk Yud. Atomer l'Abraham, garesh ha'ama hazot et benachi. Lo yirash ben ha'ama hazot im b'niyim Yitzchak. Nechama Leibowitz spends a lot of time on both of these passages dealing with how different characters refer to the people involved. So Sarah doesn't even refer to Hagar by her name. Right? Ha'ama. Sarah definitely thinks of Hagar as Ha'ama, and that's about it. Different characters have different ways of looking at them, and the narration perfectly plays this out by showing how different characters refer to Hagar, and for that matter, Ishmael, as different things. That being said, this also seems very harsh, and you would almost expect Radak and Ramban again to criticize Sarah here. In fact, Abraham Avinu doesn't like it, right? He's very uncomfortable with it. Very next pasuk. This isn't just Radak and Ramban thinking as 13th century people. Abraham Avinu, who was there, was miserable about it. So this really makes Sarah look bad. You know why they don't criticize Sarah here? They can't. Hashem supports it. Even though, you're right, Hashem supports the previous one, which actually weakens their view, here it's much more explicit. The fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu shows up and says, Abraham Avinu, you must listen to Sarah, that's it, Ramban and Radak are not going there. You can't argue with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and they know that. Here you see that inheritance are coming into play, right? And don't worry, your son Ishmael is going to also get something good because he's still part of your Zera. The rest of it, they run out of... I never understood, frankly, and I don't know if I ever will. When you go to Bimidbar Be'er Sheva, I don't know how much food and water Abraham Avinu gave to them, but it doesn't sound like it was all that much. It sounds like they ran out very quickly and suddenly are starving to death and miserable. I don't understand. Presumably, Abraham must have thought that she was going to go somewhere inhabited rather than just roaming around in a desert, but it's very puzzling. I don't understand that part at all. What is very interesting, however, is it's a very sympathetic story where once again a malach comes and is totally, don't worry, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu hears you and everything is fine. Once again, the story is very sympathetic towards Ishmael, which is funny or interesting because, after all, HaKadosh Baruch Hu supported this banishment. Right? Now the question is, even though HaKadosh Baruch Hu supported it, we still have to wonder, why isn't this so severe? It sounds like Sarah is overreacting, unless mitzachek means something like gilui arayot. If it really means that he's a horrible monster, and he's setting a terrible model for Yitzchak, okay. But if it's anything less than that, whether it's truck playing or whether it's even cheesy, that's not good enough reason to banish mother and son into a desert where they potentially and would have starved to death, or died of thirst, were it not for angelic intervention. It's hard to imagine why this should be okay. And so here, once again, our Mefarshim have to back off because HaKadosh Baruch Hu supported it, but we still have to at least wonder it. So here, Rav Samet once again swings into action with the same four-pronged plan. We need to understand the context. We need to understand the words in their immediate vicinity and in their surrounding context as well. So here we turn to Code of Hammurabi, paragraphs 170 and 171. It governs this case too. Wouldn't you know it? Here's how the rules work for this particular type of case. If the boss, in this case Avraham Avinu, has children from both the main wife, in this case Yitzchak, and also from a concubine or from a maid such as Yishmael, the father has the choice. He has two options here. He can proclaim, I adopt, in this case Yishmael, as a son, in which case he inherits as much as Yishmael does, or maybe because he's the firstborn, he'll inherit more, however that system works. But Avraham Avinu has the legal right to adopt. If, on the other hand, he does not make this proclamation and he dies, the assumption is that he did not adopt anybody, and the assumption is therefore he's properly married. So, from this point of view, Avraham Avinu never officially proclaimed adoption, so far as we know, in the Torah. But it's also possible that his incredible love for Yishmael, which is obvious both in this story and also Perek Yitzayim, even when HaKadosh Baruch Hu comes and tells him, don't worry, Sarah is going to have a child too, what's Avraham Avinu's response, besides laughing? I love Yishmael. It really sounds like he's a son. It sounds to us, at least, it's not a legal inheritance proclamation of adoption, but there's good reason to believe that Avraham Avinu wants his son Yishmael to be part of the players, not to be one of the sons of the concubine. By the way, Avraham Avinu, elsewhere in the Torah, this is one of the classic good trivia questions that you will know. I mean, presumably you know. How many sons just in the Torah, not in various midrashim, how many sons in the Torah does Avraham Avinu have? The answer is 8. He has the two that we're very familiar with, and most people say those two, but he had 6 more with the woman in Keturah, right? What did he do with those sons of Keturah? He did, exactly. He did this, right? In other words, source number 4 over here. Vayitan Avraham et kol asher lo liyitzchak, uvna pilagshim asher l'Avraham natan Avraham matanot, vayishalachem me'al yitzchak beno v'odenu chai. He made sure that they were sent away, meaning they're not going to be his heirs. He might have liked them, but it doesn't matter. This sending them away was a sure sign that they were not going to be inheritors. And so on and so forth. So Sarah Imenu, when she says Garesh ben Hamaza befina, it has nothing to do with what the mitzvah hiking is about. Again, it could just be playing with trucks. Sarah wants to make sure that there is a clear sign that Avraham Avinu is doing the same thing that he later will do with Bnei Keturah. Namely, get them out of the house so that way he is not going to be an heir. Why? Ki lo yirash ben ha'amazot im b'ni Yitzchak. That's exactly her concern. It's not one of influence, it's one of inheritance.
So the Mitzvah doesn't necessarily have something to do with what Sarah is telling Avraham to do. So what's the point?
Why is it here? You're asking very well. I'm aware of the problem. I can't answer it fully one way or the other, but because of the range of meaning, in other words, to me it's a tarifiyun no matter what it means, because I'm not sure how that fits in. Sarah clearly is concerned with matters of inheritance in this passage. Your question is better than anything I could answer you. I think it's a powerful question. Yeah. But I don't think it refutes what we're saying. It's just it's an interesting question in its own right.
Well, why shouldn't Yishmael inherit, assuming he's not it's Avraham's son, and unless there's some, I mean, it's nice for her to say, I want my son to have all the inheritance, but unless we understand that in some way it's been really bad, doesn't seem to justify Sarah's, I understand her concern, but it doesn't seem to justify the claim.
It may not be, I hear what you're saying. I don't think it refutes one or the other, though. I think the whole point is still Sarah is being a good mom. In other words, she knows that Yishmael is not equal to Yitzchak. She is the Gevira and Hagar is the Shidchak. From her point of view, Yitzchak should get it all. Whether that's because she's thinking just as a good mom, whether it's because she's thinking covenantally, that she's not just thinking as a regular mother, but rather as, this is a promise from HaKadosh Baruch Hu we're talking about, and I don't want Yishmael to have a piece of the pie, let alone half of that pie. You know, you can have a much more noble version of that also. It doesn't have to. So I think that Mitzapek is a good floating variable that's important. I don't think that it refutes or supports one side or the other.
Okay. Why can't you... How are we doing Yishmael now? I mean, if Mitzapek is something strong enough that he's old enough to do something really terrible, he's naturally either over the 5-year-old trust, and it's all kind of centered around the accounts of the water that way.
I don't understand the second part.
I guess the question is that how would we ever consider Mitzvah to be really something extreme? The fact that he sent away with his mother doesn't seem to make sense that it would be something that extreme. And I guess the other side of that is, if he is sent away with his mother, granted that he must be something, a younger person, child would have you, then it doesn't seem to, either way, it doesn't seem to allow for him to be, if he's older, why should he be sent away with his mother? If he's younger than that, it doesn't seem to become something extreme. I guess it's a question.
I don't know how to answer. It's a good question. Here we're already in the realm of beyond the evidence. I don't know how to deal with that. In other words, we can speculate. I can speculate back, but I'm already beyond the realm of what I can do within the text boundaries. In other words, there's good speculation about Mitzvah. There's no question about that. There's good speculation about whether he needs his mother or not. Rav Shimshon Rafal Hirsch, in case you're not aware of his comments, Derech Agav, points out that Hagar clearly is not a Jewish mother. Why? Rosie, yeah, you know, poor starving kid, and she hides under a bush because she doesn't want to see her kid crying. So Rav Shimshon Rafal Hirsch uses this as an opportunity. Like, you know, we have such a strong family push. Hagar clearly didn't have that same sympathy. That being said, I don't know how to respond further. Yeah.
13 or 17.
He's 14 years old at the moment, give or take. Huh? Hagar? You're just saying, I mean, the Torah says why she puts him aside, because she doesn't want to see her poor starving baby, even though she's not a baby anymore, but her poor starving child dies. So there is sympathy to some degree, but it's strange that she kind of just leaves him under the bush. Now, getting back to the manager at hand, the problem is with the word garesh. Garesh et ben ha-ma-zot et ben-ha, ki lo yirash ben ha-ma-zot im b'ni yim-yitzchak. Garesh seems so harsh. Rav Salman points out in Achinami, it is kind of harsh, but it means the same thing as l'shalach sometimes in the Torah, such as in sources 5 and 6. Vayomer Hashem el Moshe, ta tireh asher ased leparo, ki biyad chazaka yishalachem, u biyad chazaka yigareshem me'artzo. In both cases, it means send them free. Right? And likewise, in source number 6, Vayomer Hashem el Moshe, od nega achar rabi al paro v'al mitzvah macharechen yishalach etchem mizeh, kishalacho kalah garesh yigareshet etchem mizeh. In both cases, they're poetic synonyms. So garesh has a slightly stronger semantic connotation. It means drive out. But it's the same family as lishalach, meaning to set free, like vayhi b'shalach paro ha'am, and so on and so forth. What's the difference? The difference is, Rav Salman argues, at least emotionally, Avraham Avinu is being asked by Sarah to banish, in the sense of free, Hagar and Yishmael. As soon as they're free, the law is, they're not slaves anymore, the law also is Yishmael can no longer inherit Avraham. That's a public sign of disinheritance. That's what Sarah would like Avraham to do. Avraham does not want to do it. Avraham wants to keep Yishmael around because he really loves him. HaKadosh Baruch Hu intervenes and says, don't worry, listen to Sarah, but Yishmael will still get his covenant also, albeit a different one. What is, going back to source number 2, just to support this hypothesis that Garesh equals Lishalach, so, Pasuk Yadali, Vayashkem Avraham Baboker, we know that Avraham listens to his wife, right? Vayashkem Avraham Baboker, Vayikach Lachem Vachem Amayim Vayitin Al-Agar, Tzama Shikma Bet HaYeled, Vayishalachaha. Right? In other words, Vayishalachaha equals Vayigarasheha. It's the same exact root. Avraham, now you understand the difference between Sarah's mentality. Sarah doesn't like Hagar. So she's really thinking, she's using the stronger term. Avraham Avinu, who loves Ishmael, is Vayishalachaha. The legal status is the same, but Avraham Avinu has a softer tone about it because he really would have preferred to keep them around. So the end, just to summarize what we have on this side of the equation, the laws governing inheritance in that era, which likely were followed by Avraham and Sarah, although of course not clear, but likely were followed by them, had exactly this situation in mind. What will Avraham Avinu do with Ishmael? Will he adopt him, or will he free him as a slave, which will also disinherit him? Sarah wants disinheritance, Avraham wants to keep him. HaKadosh Baruch Hu intervenes and says, I'm going to free him. And now of course he becomes a para adam, and as Rashbam noticed very long time ago, where did Ishmael end up in Pasuk Kaf Aleph of this passage? He becomes a para adam in none other place than Ayeshev b'midbar Paran. Right? Para adam. So Rashbam already noticed this literary similarity. He didn't just become free somewhere. Yadavka becomes free in a para, you know, para paran. And Rav Samet plays on this as well. That seems to be the finale of this story. So what do we get out of this? In both cases, we had an ancient context, which was very, very helpful in understanding the background of what Avraham and Sarah are talking about. But that doesn't replace in any which way. And in fact, if it did, that would corrupt the whole system of learning. Once upon a time, I heard a colleague of mine, actually, was giving a shiur on Yeshayahu based on the Sankhirib prism, which is this remarkably neat thing. And process of discussing it right now in Malachim with the Shiur, but in the meantime, learn about the Sancheirid prison. It's really interesting to hear what Sancheirid Bechoro Batzmo had to say about his own war career. He had very nice things to say about himself, in case you were curious. And by the way, he wasn't the only war he ever lost was against Yerushalayim, and say from Malachim and Yeshayah. So he had a very good one-loss record. But in the meantime, this individual, unfortunately, was giving the Shiur pretty much on the prism and then trying to make Malachim fit into the prism, so to speak. And unfortunately, that distorted the whole Shiur, and I felt very bad at the end, raising my hand and pointing out that the word simply in Yeshayahu or Malachim, whichever text he was using, did not say what he was saying, and the Shiur fell to pieces. The whole point of using the background is never to replace what the Torah is saying, but very much to try to understand what are the characters talking about to the best that we can. And obviously, it's still guesswork because, yes, it's very nice that the Code of Hammurabi said it, and yes, it's very nice that it was written contemporaneously to Abraham and Sarah, and yes, it's also nice that Abraham and Sarah, of course, came from Babylonia. They come from Mesopotamia, right? They didn't grow up in Canaan. That increases the plausibility of such arguments, but it doesn't prove anything. So if any of these things became proof, and we overlooked words as a result, methodologically, we'd be making a terrible mistake. What's relevant to what Rav Salman does, and one of the reasons I like him so much, is because he uses it as background context, but he's very much on the words. In other words, we could have, and in fact, not only could we, theoretically, but every last one of the points that has been made, Mefarshim already guessed at long before they knew anything about a Code of Hammurabi. I mean, these were all textually valid options beforehand. So the context followed by immediate word choice, then the surrounding parak, and the overall context leads us to the following conclusion, which is true not only of the two stories that we're looking at, but really everything in the Torah in general. One of the remarkable things about the Torah and later not is that our characters, even the greatest ones, such as Abraham and Sarah, on the one hand are regular people. They very much deal with human being issues, whether it's barrenness, whether it's sibling rivalry, whether it's laws of inheritance, whether it's property, whether it's oppression, famine, so on and so forth. These are regular things that could happen to regular people. And that's one layer of the story. The other layer of the story is that, well, they're not just regular people. These are Nevi'im and the greatest people who have ever lived. They're people who literally were chosen by HaKadosh Baruch Hu personally to begin a covenant that would last thousands of years running. And that's the blend that the Torah is trying to make about what's going on with Abraham and Sarah in this story. Sarah is thinking temporally. She's thinking about her son and her son's inheritance, understandably. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, you're right. On the temporal side, you're completely right. The law is with you. I'm going to support your decisions. But there's something much bigger going on with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, namely the covenant. And from that point of view, it's not enough to just be okay within the eyes of the laws of Hammurabi. It's important to be okay in the eyes of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. In order to achieve that, HaKadosh Baruch Hu fulfills the promise to Abraham Avinu that Yitzchak would in fact inherit Abraham's legacy, which includes not only a sheep, but something far more important, namely the spiritual covenant. But at the same time, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is interested in fulfilling the covenant with Yishmael, already promised to Hagar back in Parak Tet Zayin. Namely, HaKadosh Baruch Hu promised that Yishmael would grow to become a free nation and a great nation as part of Zerah Abraham. And the reason, Shimshon, that I said before, that it's not because Hagar is rewarded for going back, or rather because HaKadosh Baruch Hu is rewarding Abraham, is because what he says here in Parakaf Aleph, Pasuk Yud Gimel, the Gamet Ben HaMal Goyas Yimeno Kizar Achahu. HaKadosh Baruch Hu had a promise to Abraham Avinu, and these stories map out how he fulfilled all of the aspects of it, both to Yitzchak, which is our hero, but also to Yishmael, who's a very good and sympathetic character in both of these stories. And ultimately, of course, what I don't know if Rav Salman is trying to make this point, but it seems so obvious that he wants to say this but can't say it because that would turn into a Moser Shmuz rather than just the Shiur is trying to give. That's what we're like, right? That's the whole point of when we study the Torah. We're regular people, and we live lives like anybody else in the world lives regular lives. We connect to the Torah, which makes us connected to something far greater than ourselves, something which is literally eternal, something which is Dvar Hashem. And stories like this come to illustrate role modelship, not only in terms of local behavior, but in terms of the whole point of our existence, namely that we do look beyond ourselves and we become something of part of eternality as a result of looking up to Dvar Hashem.
The parallel means that independent
if you take Yad Kol Bo to mean, here's a guy who's going to beat people up and steal their stuff, then yes, it's negative, and then Pere Adam should probably be barbarian, right? If Yad Kol Bo means something else, look at Ibn Ezra. So he, in other words, there are different ways of reading any of these expressions. From the point of view of covenantalness, and certainly based on Parakaf Aleph, if you want to jump over there, Yishmael is not viewed negatively. He's viewed very much as a sympathetic figure who's going to become a great nation because he's Avraham Avinu's son. And funny enough, by the way, of all of our neighbors, we had a lot of neighbors that we didn't like very much during the times of Tanakh. B'nai Lot didn't do us very many favors. B'nai Adom weren't very nice all the time. B'nai Ishmael hardly ever gave us any trouble. One of the interesting features about... Alas, I'm aware of that, but in Tanakh, B'nai Ishmael were really not our headache, which is interesting. But there's a certain respectfulness towards Ishmael running literally from cover to cover in Tanakh, both in these stories here and really running all the way down. Alas, I'm aware of some of the changes in history as well. I gave a drasha a few years ago, actually, talking about how the Torah really despises Plishtim and loves Ishmael. And so it kind of played out how Ishmael is very faithful and he's a loving son, whereas the Plishtim betray every covenant they ever made, and so on and so forth, and they're horrible, and they terrorize him, and this and that and the other thing. And you can see where these things might go, drasha-wise, but in Tanakh it actually works out very well historically, how these two nations became such different people, but alas, if you blend them together, it can create problems, unfortunately. Okay, so I'm basically done. I thank you all for coming. Yashar Koch Lachem. And I hope, by the way, for further iyun, just before I close, so I just put down where you can find all of Rav Samet's shiurim on the web, and I wrote a review of this stuff. So originally I was going to give a bunch of examples, and I'm like, yeah, I can give those out, and then I can talk about one more in depth. So please, before you go, you can take them, and the other things are strongly recommended as well.